Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Come July the 15th, if nothing else changes, the residents of Cape Town in South Africa are going to have their taps, their water taps, forcibly turned off. And they'll be forced to queue for water rations. If it happens, it'll be the result of 3 years of drought combined with a growing population which has seen capacity in the city's six reservoirs reduced to 26%. Day zero, as it's been called, will arrive once the reservoir levels fall to 13%. You just have to think for a few moments about what that would mean. They are saying, that's authorities in Cape Town, that people will be forced after that to queue for water. Everyone will have a daily ration of perhaps 20 to 25 litres. Considering every time you flush the toilet, you use about 8 to 9 litres, that's not very much water. If it can happen in Cape Town, can it happen in Australia? In fact, the answer is yes. Brisbane was facing critically low levels of water back in 2006, and other towns have come close to running out of water in Australia. So how well prepared are we to face another series of droughts, particularly as our population continues to climb? Tonight we're going to explore Australia's urban water use and thinking about what we need to do better if we're to avoid the fate of Cape Town. Our guests are Dr. Ian Wright from the School of Science and Health at Western Sydney University, who's here in the studio with me. Ian, good to have you on board.
Good evening, Phil.
Welcome to Nightlife. In Adelaide, at the end of the poor old benighted Murray River, of course, a state and town and city where water issues are never far from front of mind, we're joined by Professor Mike Young from the Centre for Global Food and Resources at Adelaide University. He holds a chair in environmental and water policy. Mike, good to have you on board as well. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip, and thank you for having us on board.
Yeah. Ian, paint a picture. Things have got a little better in Cape Town, but how critical is it?
It's definitely still critical, Phil. I've just looked at the latest update. Right. They publish they call it a dashboard on Cape Town. Mm-hmm. Sadly, there was no rain last week, but I think it's working. I think there's a public relations campaign going on, mm-hmm. and it's working, and they've dropped their consumption down to an average per person of 106 litres per day. So they
compared to what did they use before?
I saw it at about 140 litres per day a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
So it was much, much higher than that previously. And by comparison, the average level in Australia is around about 300 litres per person per day.
Is that right? We use around 300 litres per person per day each.
Oh, prior to 1990 in Sydney, it was 500 plus.
You're kidding?
No, absolutely not. The good old days to some people, the profligate waste of water to others. Hmm. But the situation has definitely got a bit better in Cape Town. But I'd have to say they have a very Mediterranean climate and they have winter rains, and the winter rains haven't come for the last couple of years. So really they're waiting and spinning the wheel for sort of the climate roulette to see if the rain comes in. And it comes in about what they classify as day zero, so the middle of July. So we'll see.
It's a city of what, 500,000 people? Sorry, not 500,000, about 400,000 people.
Much more.
Yeah.
It's actually very close to Sydney. It's roughly 4 million. It's not 100% clear because they've had such sudden growth because it is a wealthier part of Africa. Mm. So there's been a lot of migrants within Africa and also within South Africa.
How can you possibly turn the taps off in a city of 4 million people?
I just can't actually conceive of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, walking around a built-up area, you know, like we're in here at Ultimo, can you imagine some people, like a single mum, queuing for water for five kids for her 25 litres per person?
Hmm.
And there'll be 200 points scattered around the city. So that would be an average of about 20,000 each. If you don't have transport, it's just, it boggles my mind, quite frankly.
Well, how can, and what can people do with 25 litres of water? You can't, I mean, many people what are you going to do with it? Carry it home?
I've done some water sampling with 25 litres of water, and that fully occupies me for a very short distance, I must say.
That weighs 25 kilos. Most people probably couldn't lift that much.
Absolutely right. And then when you get home, what can you do with it? Well, you know, in Australia, that's three flushes of the toilet and it's gone.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, just let's concentrate on that for a second. I mean, this is a city of more than 4 million people, as you say. I mean, the simple sanitary arrangements for a city like that, the sewage system. Do they have any plans about that?
The recommendations. I've just actually had a student of mine who's travelled through there, and she took photos of the posters that are plastering the city with the advice. And at the moment, the last thing you would ever touch would be the flush button on the toilet. Mm. You would use grey water, you know, collect water when you have your 2 minute shower, or when you've washing up or the washing machine, and 25 litres just doesn't go far with the hygiene of life. Mm. They talk sponge baths instead of normal showers, and it's incredible to think.
Mm. Yeah. What likelihood do you think? I mean, we don't know, do we? It either rains or it doesn't. Even if it does rain, it doesn't necessarily mean the crisis is over anyway.
Look, that's right. They've got fairly small reservoirs in comparison to many Australian cities. We store a lot of water per person. We've got tend to have variable flow in our rivers, so we catch what we can and store it. They don't have that. Their dams were actually full just over 3 years ago, so it was a sudden and intense drought. But if it follows the trajectory that Perth has experienced, it just does not look good. It looks very, very grim.
Yeah, I mean, many people think, I mean, Mike, jump in here whenever you like too. Many people think that Perth might be the first cab off the rank if there was to be a water crisis in Australia. Why do you think that?
I think it actually is the first example. Back in 1974, there was an average amount of water that flowed into the dams around Perth. And then suddenly something happened in 1974, and it started off and everybody said it's a drought, then it's a long drought, and then it's a very, very long drought. They've now worked out it's actually climate change. And if you work out the average amount of water that used to flow into Perth up until 1974, since 1974 they have never once had the average amount of water available. And the amount of water, it's essentially the average halved. Perth was lucky. It had access to groundwater. It quickly moved to actually desal, and it managed through the process. And it's now gone through into recycling sewage, not actually directly, but actually treating the water and pumping it back into groundwater and then bringing it out again. So it's become a very, very water-efficient city, supported also through some desal plants. So there's been a really big shift there. The lessons are very, very clear. Plan for sudden shifts and make sure you've structured things so it'll work. And one of the other things that they were able to do is to move water from agriculture through into the city.
Mm. Any historian or archaeologist will tell you that a study of the history of Australia shows that the climate has changed a number of times. You know, Indigenous people changed accordingly, abandoned places, certain places to live, and repopulated others, and so on. Are we just a bit blind to all of this, do you think?
Well, I think firstly, Perth does offer an example that a lot of people in other parts of Australia do not realise how sudden and severe and long term that was. I absolutely agree with what Mike said, and I think Perth has been a leader in adapting to that. And
yeah, what's the solution, Mike, for Perth? I mean, Perth's by the sea. Can we talk about desal for a moment? Is desal the answer for coastal cities? I know people describe desal as bottled electricity because they do chew up huge amounts of electricity to run. Is that still the case? And could you supply the city of Perth from a desal augmented by natural collection?
Yes, you can, but it's very, very expensive. It's about three times the price of water from a dam as a general guideline around the world. So you can do it, but it's a lot cheaper to take the water out of agriculture and to recycle it. Unfortunately, salt glues itself to water very, very tightly, and so it's very expensive to take the salt out of the water. It's a lot cheaper, by the way, to take out nitrate and phosphate, which is what sewage is. So if you sit down and say, okay, you're short of wattage, the smart thing to do is to take sewage and treat it. Now, we tried that in Toowoomba, and organised a referendum in the drought we had in 2006. And the people of Toowoomba resoundingly said, no, we will not drink sewage, full stop, we will not go there. But it's a much cheaper solution, and the technology is now good enough and safe enough to do it. And countries around the world are now looking at that as an option.
Mm. Okay, all right. What about for a big city like Melbourne or Sydney? Is desalination an option for those?
Yes, but it's expensive. It's cheaper in a Melbourne's case to transfer water from places like Shepparton in the Murray and bring it through rather than to switch on a desal plant.
Mm.
Much, much cheaper. Irrigation water is not expensive when it's used in a household. And it's not a lot of farms you need to shut down to supply a city.
Hmm. Okay. All right. You say the cost factors are about three, is it?
Yes, that's certainly a rule of thumb. It's about three times as expensive as actually water from a dam that's treated.
Hmm. In fact, back to how much we use every day. I mean, a number of texters are saying, hang on, 300 litres per person per day? There's no way that I would use that much water. Does that, I mean, if we drill down into that a bit, is that an average of what goes into residential houses, or does it include business consumption as well?
That's, as I understand, that's residential consumption. Hmm. And it's not hard for the water authorities to get this sort of data because they've got a meter on each of our houses. So they've got pretty good data on it. But I did some comparisons the other day. Sydney Water put out really good statistics about the amount of water used each day.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest I could find, we had a warm day in Sydney towards the end of February, just the day before Australia Day, Sunday the 25th, and we used 2,000 megalitres collectively,
mm-hmm.
a city of 5 million people. So roughly the same size as Cape Town. We used four times as much water, and on that day we used, on average, across Sydney, 406 litres per person. It's highly dependent on the temperature. So roughly a third of our water in the domestic house in Australia is used in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
So those green lawns at the moment are coming at quite a price and topping up the pool, et cetera.
Yeah, the water supply in Sydney, of course, if we don't use it, it's not as though we can accumulate more and more of it forever, though. It's in a dam, and of course the dam does fill up, and if it fills up and gets to a certain point, it spills, which it has in recent years. So, I mean, water savings useful when the water is in scarce supply, but the trouble is, in some parts of Australia, Sydney at the moment, it's not, is it?
Not at the moment. We're about, I think, 77% at the moment. Bureau of Meteorology's got a really good website, and it's a dashboard across Australia. So today, what's the lowest? Oh, Perth as ever, is sitting at about 35%.
Hmm.
Sydney's 77%.
South Australians, Mike, have always been much more conscious of water and its scarcity than perhaps anybody else in Australia. How much water do they use in South Australia per person on average?
It's about the same. I haven't got actually the latest data in front of me. In the drought, we got way down in the same way as actually Brisbane. Everybody became actually water literate. People were looking at each other's gardens and stopping it off. We have learnt, though, interestingly, with the desal plant, that if there's any fear about water contamination, you can suddenly switch on a plant and use it for a second source, which is safety. Brisbane, through the floods, had the same thing, and suddenly it was looking like it was going to be short of water, and they looked to their plant there, and they nearly switched it on and used it as a backup. In fact, I think they might have switched it on briefly to bring it back in to capacity. So when you talk to desal people, they stress that it's there as a reliable alternative supply. The bit of knowledge that's probably not understood by most is that to keep a desal plant working, you must keep it ticking over. Recently, they had to try and start up Melbourne's plant, having mothballed it totally, and it took a huge amount of time to get it back up and running. And people now stress that the smart thing to do is to keep them idling and completely functioning right throughout, so that when you need to use them quickly, you can. And there's now that understanding there.
Mm.
So technology is changing, but it's still very, very expensive. And there's always the option of taking it out of agriculture.
If we ran desal plants everywhere, we would need to find new sources of electricity generation, wouldn't we? Because they're huge users of electricity. We're already arguing about whether we've got enough electricity capacity in the country.
If and we also started climate change, which is actually part of it, if you're going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So if we add another whole layer of electricity usage on top of what we've already got, we're a dog chasing its tail here, aren't we?
Exactly.
But most of the water authorities are aware of this, so they've set up offsets. Mm-hmm. So, for example, for the plant in Sydney at Kurnell, they've built a wind farm down at Bungendore. So it's an offset. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to generate electricity at the same time. But I understand most of the plants have renewable electricity. Mike might know more about that than I do.
Sue says, Phil, it's not true to say that Perth's water crisis in the 70s was sudden. Even a cursory search of the literature in the 1960s forewarned of water shortages. I mean, Ian, you were saying before we came on air that you're worried about the fact that we're kind of sleepwalking towards a crisis in Australia, that we get energised about it occasionally when dam levels fall and we don't water our gardens, but once it starts raining again, we forget all about that.
Well, that's my experience, particularly here in the east, you know, southeast Queensland, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra. We tend to have plenty of available quality water most of the time. And then we have these occasional shocks like the Millennium Drought, which gave us an incredible fright. And then there was an incredible flurry of political interest, media stories, and working in the water industry at the time, people were very, very aware of it. And we're quite happy to dob in the neighbour who washed the boat at night time and, you know, watered the lawn outside of the hours. And then the dams are full, it's dropped off the agenda. And my concern is, with the uncertainties of climate change, looking at something like Perth, but also our populations are increasing. And when, you know, there's plans in both Melbourne and Sydney to add a couple of extra million people, but we might have a reduced ability to supply them with stored rainwater.
Okay, we can use desal, but as I think both of you have said, it is cheaper by far to use the water we have and to recycle the water that we currently have. I wonder, Mike, whether you raised the Toowoomba issue before about recycled sewage. There was a particularly virulent political campaign of negativity in and around that subject. I wonder in the future whether there would be such negativity towards the notion of drinking recycled water. I mean, in the big cities, they say it already happens. Isn't there that cliche that in London every glass of water you drunk has been drunk seven times before?
And that's the case in Adelaide too. When I sit over here, I sometimes jokingly say that I'm consuming Canberra's sewage because it flows down through actually the Murrumbidgee into the Murray and through into Adelaide. So we're already doing it indirectly, and Perth is doing it indirectly as well. So we are relaxed about indirect recycling. Direct recycling is something that has to be managed carefully, and it's a matter of doing it slowly and bringing it in as an idea. Singapore has done it very, very successfully. It started with its school children supplying recycled water to them in bottles, and so the school children became used to it. So it is possible, and I'm certainly over in the United States in Orange County, there's been recycling there for many, many years of sewage. We are able to do it. One of the things that stands out to me is that through the drought we had at the start of this century, we set up a National Water Commission, and that National Commission's role was to make sure that our urban water supply standards were secure enough, and they started processes with each of our cities to do checklists to make sure that they had adequate plans and to make sure that the standards were there, and we learnt from the past. Recently, the government decided that we were now such excellent water managers, we didn't need that commission anymore, and so it was shut down. I can see a very strong case for bringing a National Water Commission or something like it back, so that there's a small group of people whose job it is to audit what's going on and make sure we have adequate standards, because it's so vital to our future.
Just back to the sleepwalking idea again, because I suppose the question I want to ask is, what fundamentally has changed about the way that we use water from the from the Millennium Drought that you're talking about? I mean, apart from the construction of some desalination plants, we could build more, I suppose. There's been no really fundamental shift in the way that we recycle and reuse water. Has there? There's been a bit of household water collection, I suppose. Has that been significant in any way, Ian?
I've got an example for New South Wales that I think is a fantastic scheme, and Mike might know about other schemes around Australia, but it's a horrible acronym called BASICS, and it's a building sustainability index. Mm-hmm. So any new developer, and there's a lot of developers around Sydney at the moment, they have to put in a plan that's going to reduce water consumption by 30 to 40%. So they've got to have low water use appliances. They've got to have things like low water use shower heads, a landscaping plan, dual flush toilets, grey water reuse, water tank, etc., etc. And again, Sydney Water, because they've got a water meter on the front of the house, they've measured this and they're getting 40% improvement. And I'm proud of that. The developers are actually are proudly advertising this in their brochures. Mm. And some of the biggest schemes are actually doing their own recycling. So houses get a second meter with a purple pipe with recycled water, which is basically recycled sewerage, and people use that for lawns, for toilets, and non-potable uses.
Mm, that's true, but those grey water systems require dual piping systems, which really are only practical in new developments. I mean, the vast areas of already built developments can't use grey water because there's no dual piping system or way to utilise it, apart from, you know, carrying it yourself, running your washing machine out onto the back step, out into the back garden. Mike, do you think there's been a fundamental shift in the way that we actually use water since the Millennium Drought? Or
yes, and it's one of the things that worries me most. I can list some other things we've done, but what we've really done is hardened our demand for water. Mm-hmm. In the long drought we had a lot of room for improvement. We could adopt all the things that Ian's been talking about, and we went very quickly down that road. We had a lot of things we could switch off and a lot of ways to save water. When you go to basics type schemes, you lose the opportunity to improve your efficiency because you're so efficient, there's nothing else you can do. And so it then means that cities have to plan even more for the sudden shocks. If one of our cities had a supply shop, such as happened in Perth, they now have to move even faster than they had to previously, because in the good old days, there was lots of room for improvement. Now we've moved to systems that are much more demanding on having a fixed supply of water. So, in fact, it's become harder rather than easier. And something else we've moved into is actually a thing called a water-sensitive urban design, where essentially you capture stormwater and you use that stormwater. You send it into an aquifer, you store it in local storages, use it to water supply for trees and so forth in the streets. But all that means that that's a fixed water supply. It's outside that critical supply system which is needed to keep houses supplied with water. Mm. So we're actually making it tougher for ourselves, not easier. Yes, it's cheaper. It might save water and it might be sensible, but it means we have to be even more responsive than we used to be.
We're talking about water and the urban water crisis that is afflicting many parts of the world. Cape Town is our jumping off point here tonight, but we have established that it could easily happen here in Australia, and probably Perth is the city that our experts are looking at most keenly tonight. Dr. Ian Wright from Western Sydney University and Professor Mike Young from Adelaide University. The trouble with desal plants, to you, Mike and Ian, is that they are vastly expensive to build, vastly expensive to run, and generally, as you say, sit idle when dams and other reservoirs are full. And the cost of having them sit idle is also vast. You've done some figures on this, Ian.
Yeah, the Sydney plant at Kurnell costs Sydney Water, and therefore the consumers of Sydney, about $200 million a year just to sit idle. It's actually a little bit less than that. Yeah. But that's a very, very substantial amount of money. And what I found particularly interesting when I went through Sydney Water's annual report, not just the large sums of money involved, but they spend almost exactly the same amount on desal, which at the moment is just an insurance policy. It doesn't provide water, as the water that they use. So that's the water from the dam system, Warragamba, Avon Cataract, Cordo. Sydney's got a great collection of dams managed by Water New South Wales. Well, that cost about $200 million. So we pay about the same amount. The price is likely to go up. When the levels come down, if and when they come down to 60% capacity, it'll trigger the desal plant to be switched down. But it'll only provide a fairly small percentage of Sydney supply, something in the order of about 25%.
Okay. In Cape Town's situation, Mike, I mean, is that the answer for them, do you think? That the only way they're going to get out of this is with desal?
No, they're going into groundwater quickly and trying to save water as well. So it's one of the things they're doing. They're also looking to agriculture and seeing if they can get more water out of there. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they've decided to build temporary desal plants rather than permanent ones. I understand the World Bank was consulted and they said, develop your groundwater source first and see if you can use groundwater as your new dam. And start recycling back in, so taking sewage and putting it back in there, because that's a lot cheaper than having a desal plant. So desal plants are being built, the temporary plants, rather than the Australian solution, which is a permanent plant which sits idling at very, very expensive costs. Think about somewhere between $30 and $50 per person.
How do you build a temporary desal plant? I mean, they're major pieces of technology. How do you make that temporary?
You don't set the same standards. You do things like actually take water from the sea and flick it back in, not being overly concerned about salinity impacts.
Oh, okay.
You use a lot of stopgap measures rather than sitting there and building things at very high standard. You know, for example, Adelaide decided with its desal plant not to harm the coast at all. So that meant they tunneled through into the sea, so from the cliff face you can't see the desal plant, rather than having pipes going over the cliff and into the sea. So these things all add cost, and you'd expect a country like Australia to set very high environmental standards and make sure you don't have any problems. If you have the return water is very saline. If it's not diffused very carefully back into the sea, it starts to accumulate and you have a dead sea, which is a highly saline sea, and everything in the sea starts to die. So you need to be careful how you put it together if you're going to make a permanent plant. But you can have a temporary plant bought in. But they're hoping that this is a 3 or 4 year drought, not a permanent shift as happened in Perth.
Mike and Ian, just back to both of you. We've talked about coastal cities, of course, the big ones, Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth, all of which could use desal at vast expense and with some difficulty. But of course, that doesn't help the major inland regional towns of Australia, doesn't it? Broken Hill, Bendigo, Ballarat, places like this will. How would they fare if? We've already seen in New South Wales, Goulburn actually, which is quite a large inland city, come to within, I think, less than 20% of its water supplies were available at one point, and they'd rationed water. So it's not as though these things are theoretical, are they?
Oh, absolutely. And Goulburn got to level 5 restrictions, and if people want to know what level 5 restrictions means, they drained the swimming pool. It was that bad. They couldn't use water off of playing fields, so some sport was cancelled. But Goulburn literally got a lifeline. A pipeline was built from the Highlands, from the Southern Highlands, and it actually taps into part of the Sydney's water supply. Windjacarabee Dam, which is an interbasin transfer, it's kind of stolen from the Shoalhaven River, pumped up the hill. Some goes to Sydney, some goes to the Southern Highlands.
Still, we're still arguing over the same size of cake, though, aren't we?
well, that's right, and that's often the answer. So Broken Hill at the moment, as Mike would know, I'm sure, is currently building a massive pipeline, 270 kilometres, to actually bring water from the Murray River all the way to Broken Hill.
This is the Murray River, of course, which has got such bountiful and plentiful supplies that we can afford to give it away willy-nilly.
Oh, that's right, absolutely.
Yeah, Mike, but in the long run, we're going to need some fundamental shifts in behaviour, aren't we?
I think we're going to have to plan.
Sorry, Mike, can you just start again there, because we'd missed you, Mike, there. We're going to need some fundamental shifts in behaviour, aren't we, Mike?
Very much so, some very big shifts in behaviour and in the systems that are used to allocate water around the world. And that's clear. And you're right that it's the small towns that'll probably end in strife first. I was over in the United States recently in the town of Porterville, and they ran out of water and they were able to truck it in, and they just used tankers to drive in the water from other areas. And you do that as step one. Step two is you pipe the water in. And step three is you find other sources from wherever you can. If you can't, then ultimately people have to live elsewhere. And we're entering into a world now where water scarcity is becoming common. By 2050, the projection is that something like half of the world's people will be experiencing water scarcity, which means they won't have enough water to meet all their needs. So we're going to have to see people moving in response to water, and industries moving into response to water supplies.
How much water do you think we could get it down to? You're saying at the moment people in cities use about 300 litres, residential people use about 300 litres per person per day. Given that a city needs water to, people need water to drink, to prepare food, to wash themselves, and importantly to keep the drains working, whether there's sewage and other drains working, what do you think realistically people could get it down to, Ian?
I think we've demonstrated that with some of the emergencies we've been through with towns and water restrictions. And I think down towards the low hundreds, 150 litres or so, that figure comes to my mind as well, because the United Nations has looked at water use around the world, and that's what our brothers and sisters in the UK use, 150 litres per person per day.
What are your thoughts, Mark? Do you think that's realistic?
I think that's realistic. If you go to cities like actually Phoenix in the United States, in Arizona, they have no gardens that are watered at all. They just have cacti, and they live in the desert, and they've turned it into a retirement community, really. It's a huge city, about actually 4 million people, I think, roughly that sort of size. And they have achieved very low numbers by essentially restricting water use back into houses full stop. So there's no outside water use. And they've got massive efficiencies of the type.
So if you build a house there, it doesn't have an outside tap?
No. And as well as that, sometimes there's a small one, so you can wash your car and things like that and have a little bit of water carrying out, but you're not allowed to water any gardens or anything like that. So they live in a desert. Do you think we might respect it?
Might we get to that point in this country that people will be told you can't have a garden?
Not while we're affluent, because we'll be prepared to pay to have the water taken from the sea. And I can see us recycling more and more, and that's going to become part of what we start to do around the world, and certainly in Australia, and we can see that in Perth. I can see it in Adelaide coming soon. In fact, Adelaide now puts virtually no sewage into the Gulf. It's all sent back to our parklands and up into agricultural areas and used to grow tomatoes and things like that, lettuces. So we're already recycling effectively, and that's part of the education. If you have a shower and you recycle water, you don't actually use any water at all. The same volume is still there. It's a very important thing to understand. Water goes round and round unless you evaporate it or actually send it to the sea. So once you start recycling, you don't need much water. It can go round and round and round and round and around again.
All right, let's take some calls. Kevin, hi.
Oh, hello.
G'day, Kevin.
I was just wondering whether sand could be used as a type of salination project over there, because sand is the best filter known. For instance, a lot of people use water from groundwater that is filtered through sand, and it does, I live in a very big coastline, and the water directly behind the dunes is fresh. You know what I mean? Because everywhere is sand. I'm talking about the Stockton Bight, of course, and the sand that is plentiful. Couldn't it be shipped over there and used in some form or another as a desalination?
Does sand desalinate, Ian? Does it?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, it's a very important filter, and lots of our aquifers lie in sand. But not aware of it. You know, like Mike said earlier, it's very, very hard to get salt out of water.
Yeah. Zach, hello.
Hi.
G'day.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to know your guest's perspective on... you talk about the expense of desalination, and I've never been a fan of that. But what about evaporative plants? Because you evaporate salt water and you get fresh water, do you not? And the other aspect was, well, one time I travelled to Paris and they recycle all their sewage water. Goes in the same, goes out the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing was the amount of potable water that's treated, it's only about, from what I understand, about 5% that we actually drink or get anywhere near our mouths. And couldn't we save a lot of expense by running two lines to houses, one that's drinking water and one that's
grey water? Yeah, they are doing. I mean, well, they are doing this, aren't they? In new developments, it's just that the way that the existing water supplies are set up, we don't do this.
But we used to do it. I'm sad to say, yeah. Rouse Hill in Western Sydney is one of the biggest schemes in the world where they did it for 32,000 properties.
What, have they stopped doing it? Have they?
They've stopped doing it, and I think one of the problems there is financial. They actually, the prices are set by, in New South Wales, we have a pricing tribunal, and the price is about a third of what it costs Sydney Water to make it. So there's no real financial incentive. In fact, they'll lose money on every single litre. Whereas I think setting up these schemes, you need a lot of time, a huge investment, and it's got to stack up in terms of dollars rather than get into a crisis and start doing that.
Mike, whatever happened to household water collection, i.e. through water tanks? I mean, is that actually a realistic policy path to go down, given all the complications involved with public health and all of that? I mean, is it? We seem to get enthusiasms for these things for a bit, and then it all seems to die away. What's wrong with mandating mandatory water collection in your house?
South Australia's done it, and it is mandatory in amazing new houses to have a rainwater tank.
Mm.
But it's very expensive unless the water is used. Rainwater tanks that are useful are empty, not full, because then when it rains, you've got water to capture. If all you're using is your water tank to give a supply of water for a cup of coffee occasionally, that's not using much water. You have to have it plumbed into your toilets and your washing machines and things like that, and it has to be part of the use system. Mm. So we've found in South Australia that, in fact, you've got to work very, very hard to plumb your whole house differently. It's not just a matter of having a water tank. And secondly, it's a very, very expensive way of accessing water. Desal is cheaper than a rainwater tank.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now hang on, just take us through that. Why is that?
Because tanks are expensive to install, they take up land, and the opportunity cost of having them is very, very high, particularly if you don't use them very much. You've got to work out how much water you're going to take from your own rainwater tank and whether or not you can actually disconnect totally. I was raised in a farm, and our farm had four very, very large water tanks to supply our house with water. It was a massive storage area, so to get the water you need for a house, and we were very cautious with our water because it was so valuable, and it needed very, very big storages. So rainwater tanks don't really solve much of the problem. They feel good, they look good, and they'll certainly open up options, but once again, they're expensive.
Is there a way that we could improve them, though? I mean, could we, if we said, look, every toilet in a new development has to have its own rainwater tank, for example?
Yes, we could do that, and you can design houses differently, but they have to be gravity fed, ideally. So you need to have the water higher than your toilet and your showers and all those sorts of things. So you can do it. They're perfect for actually washing machines and also for flushing toilets. But then you've got to keep it so it's all plumbed together.
Hmm.
And that's a design challenge. And so far in Australia, we haven't gone very far down that pathway. But when it was costed out by people like Quentin Grafton, they worked out that the cost from memory was about $5 $6 a kilolitre, and desal is about $3 a kilolitre. From a dam supply, it's about actually $1 a kilolitre. So we need to understand costs and think about what we're really trying to do here.
Jenny says
water is still very cheap. You know, it's like sand. A trailer load of actually water is worth about $30, the same as sand. So it's a very heavy, cheap commodity.
Well, it needs to be too, isn't it? I mean, it's a very basic commodity, and basic commodities ought to be cheap because that's what they are, basic commodities. You're shaking your head here, Ian, thinking it ought to be more expensive, are you?
I hate suggesting something should be more expensive, but I've talked to lots and lots of different community groups, and the number of people that have been offended with how cheap our water is, how we value it, or what we pay for it can be quite different. So the 300 litres per person per day in Sydney at the moment is worth about 60 cents. So several days would be worth the price of a cup of coffee. Is that really what it is worth for us? And I don't think that's sending the right price signal. So as Mike says, it's quite expensive to set up water tanks and all the plumbing. Really, it's just cheaper to use a lot of water in many cases. And when there is so much pressure, particularly with electricity bills going up, Sydney Water and Melbourne Water are in the process of bringing bills down. So in some ways, the price signal is allowing people, encouraging people to use more water.
Okay, all right, back to some calls. Jeanette, hi.
Oh, how are you, Phil?
Good, very well, thanks.
I'll be quick. I've got a couple of questions and a statement. Would you ask one of your guests, where does natural spring water come from? Will it ever run out? Why are we not stopping people bottling that and selling it and chucking their bottles everywhere?
Very good questions, Jeanette. Who wants to have a go here, Ian?
Oh, look, I'm happy to answer that. I mean, spring water comes from groundwater. It depends where your groundwater is coming from. I do lots of field work in the Blue Mountains, and most of the creeks up there are fed by natural springs. Beautiful, clean, geologically filtered water, but there's lots of bores in the area, that can dry up. And I absolutely agree with Jeanette's point about plastic bottles. Bane of my life, and what a waste of money.
Yes, the bottled water industry. Does the bottled water industry have any benefits at all, Mike? Does it in some other ways?
Yes, in terms of convenience. I miss having the old water bubblers. I remember when I was at school, we all had little fountains that we used to walk up to and drink from. Now, a few of those around Adelaide now, they've been actually restored back into the city, and we give drinking water out free to people who do it. But you can still buy bottled water everywhere. And the reality is that it is very popular, and there is a big demand for actually bottles of water. And, you know, I even actually myself naughtily have them in the car. I should have a separate container, which is aluminium, but I don't. Somehow it's easier. But that's the reality we are. I'm actually facing up to around the world. And I think we'll go on. I'm always having water available in bottles in the same way as soft drinks are also available.
Do you think we're likely to have water wars into the future, Mike? I mean, some people have suggested this, that you know, the Cape Town, Sao Paulo nearly ran out of water too at one stage. That, you know, when big cities like this are struggling for resources, they'll. I mean, it's the recipe for a war.
I think you can have water riots if you start to run out of water. I can see that happening around the world. Water wars is a very interesting thing. That's normally between nations. And the issue there is, can you stop the flow in a river as a strategy to starve a nation or to create a problem so you can take it over? Wars get threatened. So far in the big water resources of the world around Israel and places like that, there have not been any attempts to do it. Same in the Nile. There's been tension around, but people somehow seem to muddle through. What we don't have and desperately need are robust sharing systems, and Australia is held up as the model for the world with our River Murray and the way we have a sharing system, which is said to be the best in the world. We're fighting over the detail at the moment, but we have, I think, the world's best system in its basic design. There's room for improvement, and I expect that to happen over time. But it's a very good one. So water wars, I hope we don't have any. they will occur between nations, sometimes between states. At the moment, the states are threatening each other and saying they're going to tear up the agreement. But at the end of the day, in Australia, an agreement is an agreement and it's a contract. And in the High Court, the lawyers will argue and finally a judge will conclude that the agreement is binding.
Okay. Peter, hello.
Oh, hello. I'd just like to say I'm an ex-West Australian and I come from Port Hedland originally. My father used to cart water from Port Hedland to Marble Bar. So, you know, that was back in the late 40s, early 50s.
Hmm.
So water shortage is not just a... it's not just a new thing. It's been there for a long time. And in the end, my mother said, you can't cart water anymore because it gives it away.
Hmm.
But, you know, it's just such a... It's not a new thing. That's what I'm trying to say. It's just not a new thing. It's
yeah.
People... If we could just take it for... what am I trying to say? If we could just not take it for granted that water was just there, we need to respect it and we need to understand it. And it's just been there for a long time.
Yeah. No, I think a very sensible observation, Peter, and lies at the heart of the water debate. It's an interesting takeaway from what both of you are saying, though. You both say that, look, it's a realistic objective that Australia's domestic urban water usage per person residentially could be got down to half of what it is now. I mean, in essence, that's doubling the water supply, isn't it? Ian, is that a good way to look at it?
Depending on what happens with the population growth, but look, that's absolutely right. And I think a point Mike made earlier is a really good one. We've got a lot more room to move with recycling. And particularly, I think it's fair to say South Australia leads the way with recycling. We don't have such good statistics. Now we've lost the National Water Commission, but they're very close to 30%. And it's great to hear from Mike that they don't put any sewerage out in the sea. Well, here in Sydney, 80% of it goes out into the ocean. So for the majority of Sydney, it's used once and off it goes. Yet, perhaps ironically, we have a desalination plant that costs a lot more electricity to extract water out of it. So I think recycling will add a lot more to the supply, but reducing demand, being more efficient, is certainly part of the equation that we need to look at.
Yes, indeed. All right. Why are we pursuing a population policy, says Paul. Why are we pursuing a population growth strategy to prop up the budget, which is turbocharged with high immigration rates, with the pursuit of the latter without any consideration of basics like constraints on water supply seems negligent. Yeah, well, it's an observation that's been made, and that in this, the water debate is in many other debates too about resources, but in essence, I'm not sure that the two are linked as such, but one certainly does have an effect on the other.
I think we need to understand here that Australia has lots of water. We use it in agriculture largely.
Mm-hmm.
And Australia feeds at the moment about 70 million people. The numbers go up and down, but that's sort of order of magnitude. So we
You mean here and overseas?
Overseas, yes. Mm-hmm. And we export a huge amount of water every year, effectively in meat and in wheat and rice and everything else. We're exporting lots of product. And as our population grows, it just means we export less food and hence less water. But Australia is not short of water in an absolute sense. We use it to make money. And so water management is not a problem that we can't solve. And it's still very cheap. There's a lot of room for improving the water pricing strategies. It's crazy we have this increasing block XD tariff. Most of the people listening here on this radio today, right across Australia, will face a low charge for the first amount of water they take,
and then
it goes up to a higher price for the second quantity, and then a higher for a third one.
There might be a better way of pricing it. We're going to have to interrupt Mike because we're up against a news bulletin. But I do thank you for your time, Professor Mike Young from the Centre for Global Food and Resources at Adelaide University. Thank you. And Dr. Ian Wright from the School of Science and Health at Western Sydney University. Thanks to both you gents too for your expertise tonight.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.